Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and this week it's all about indies. I talked to one of the most enduring independent filmmakers in America, John Sayles, about his new film Honey Dripper. And we go all indie with Joy Division. As a new documentary about the Manchester band appears, I'm joined by the film's writer, John Savage. That's all to come on Film Weekly. This is the week that Iron Man becomes the first of the big summer blockbusters, and I'm pleased to report that it's rather good fun. Robert Downey Jr. plays billionaire arms dealer Tony Stark, who, on a visit to demonstrate his latest weapons of destruction to the US Army, is captured by Arabic insurgents and held prisoner in a cave. He escapes by building himself a suit of armour and keeps his heart alive with a car battery, but on return to America he realises the error of his warmongering ways and vows to change his weapons policy for the world's good. Hurrah! Well, that's all the surface, really. What makes the film is Robert Downey Jr.'s constant babble and banter with his assistant, Gwyneth Paltrow, his best friend, Terrence Howard, and his business partner, the excellently villainous Jeff Bridges. Oh, and with his pet robot, too, who helps him build a new supersuit in the garage of his opulent Malibu home. After all the brooding seriousness of recent Batman and Spider-Man films, Iron Man puts the fun back into superhero movies. It's directed impressively by Jon Favreau, the swingers actor who turned director and made Elf such a funny Christmas movie. Iron Man's got the lo-fi invention of Wallace and Gromit wrapped in a whizzy high-tech package of effects and slick visuals. It's also got an amount of self-examination about America's predilection for war and weapons, although not quite enough to make it a really remarkable film. Disappointingly, too, it heads to a Transformers-style climax, but there's enough fizz and fun here to ensure that the summer silly season gets off to a flyer.
Stark, you've been called the Da Vinci of our time. What do you say to that?
Absolutely ridiculous. I don't paint.
What do you say to your other nickname, the Merchant of Death?
That's not Ben.
They say the best weapon is one you never have to fire. I prefer the weapon you only need to fire once. That's how Dad did it. That's how America does it. And it's worked out pretty well so far.
Far away from all of that is John Sayles, the ultimate independent filmmaker, although he's not averse to script doctoring for creature features such as Alligator or Jurassic Park or even the recent Spiderwick Chronicles. Sayles is back with his 16th film as writer and director, a career which started in the late 1970s and included films such as Lone Star, Passion Fish, Eight Men Out, Sunshine State and City of Hope. His latest is Honey Dripper, a story set in the segregated cotton-picking South, telling of Danny Glover's fight to keep his live blues music shack open through one last big Saturday night, despite competition from the Duke joint opposite and before his hungry creditors come to claim their piece of pumpkin pie. It's a soulful, colourful film, elegantly written and heavy on atmosphere and music. When I met up with John Sayles to discuss his career and the part locale and music have always played in his films, I remarked that his choice of cinematographer for this setting was unusual. Dick Pope, the British cameraman, best known for collaborations with Mike Leigh on films such as Secrets and Lies, Life is Sweet, and the current Happy-Go-Lucky.
Yeah, Dick, we actually was one of the first people we hired on it, 2 years before we actually had the money to make it. And I just figured Dick had worked on those Mike Leigh films, which often don't have that much money or much time. But he'd also shot these movies like Topsy Turvy or The Illusionist, very kind of lush period movies. And so I thought it was a good combination for this. And he did a wonderful job.
Yeah, he must have thought, great. I mean, because British cinematographers, they never get to shoot, like, you know, Spanish Moss and that kind of kind of beaten up weathered shacks of the 1950s.
Yeah, we were also able to, you know, get Dick involved early enough that he was able to go and look for locations. And that's always great when the cinematographer can't just get handed things but can have a say in okay, I think I can do something with this and this is the time of day we should shoot that.
Because one of the things that people, I think, forget about your films are the location and the sense of place is crucial to them. I mean, they're always about communities in a certain spot and how people are affected by the landscape and the community in which they live. This one is no exception. If you think of Lone Star, one thinks of desertscapes. If you think of, I don't know, if you think
the mountains of West Virginia or the bayous of Louisiana for passion fish, yeah,
and the Florida for
Sunshine State,
yeah,
right.
Which again had a lot of Spanish moss in it.
Yeah, for me, where you're from and when you're from is a lot of who you are. And so I try to be as specific as possible in the American ones about that. I just think the way that you see the world, the way you interpret what goes on in front of you, and certainly in the case of Honey Dripper, it's 1950 in the Deep South. And there are certain assumptions, racial assumptions, that go on there. There is a track down the middle of the street. You're either on the white side of the track or the black side of the track. And if you're on the wrong side, people want to know why. But also the time is important in that this is the rural South in 1950. Most people don't have electricity. Still, you know, if you're you live in a sharecropper shack. So if you're going to hear music, you're not hearing it on the radio. You're either making it yourself or you're going to that, you know, tent revival or juke joint and hearing it there. And that's probably once a week on the big Saturday night.
The final scene for which is wonderful when everyone comes out of the woods with their fineries on and their kind of best clothes, and someone's packing a knife, someone's packing a gun, but most people got a sharper tie than he has got got a knife and a sharp hat. That's a wonderful scene.
Yeah, you know, one of the things I wanted to get into the rhythm of Honey Dripper is, why was that Saturday night such a big deal? Why was it so desperate sometimes? And to understand that, you really have to understand the other 6 days of the week. You have to understand that from Monday until Saturday sundown when you get paid, from can until can't, as they say in the movie, people were working really hard for very little money. But the harvest was the one time a year that everybody made cash. You know, the rest of the year you're often working on credit and you never quite get ahead. This time of year you get paid cash in your hand at the end of the week. And so you've got cash to spend. And so I think that Saturday night for people who work that hard for that little, it was their only chance to transcend their daily life, to really let it all hang out. Mm-hmm. And that could come out, that kind of transcendence, in either violence or joy. And some of what, you know, Danny Glover's character is wrestling with all the time in the movie of Honey Dripper is, which is it going to be on this Saturday night? Can I keep a lid on this thing and keep it joy and keep that violent undertone from taking over?
It's an interesting, it's a period I love. I mean, normally you tell me that a film is set in that period and features blues music when it crosses into jazz and boogie-woogie. You know, you have me at hello. I mean, I'm kind of sold. Is it something that's always interested you? Is this the sort of film you always wanted to make, but, you know, had to wait 16 films till you kind of made it?
You know, the idea kind of evolved, but certainly that music always fascinated me. I grew up in the 50s. The first record I had was Elvis Presley's Hound Dog. You know, and then as I got older and started to listen to the roots of that rock and roll and realize it came from somewhere, it came from before I was born, I really got fascinated with this kind of forgotten era in American music and history, just as the Korean War is kind of our forgotten war. This really incredible era of music that starts at the end of the swing era and then goes up until the early 50s when rock and roll kind of swept everything away in front of it. And it's this rhythm and blues era, and it's people like Louis Jordan and Big Joe Turner and Ruth Brown. Yeah. Very, very vibrant era in music, but it's just not remembered.
It's the last stand for Tyrone Purvis and the Honey Dripper Lounge.
Lucky, give me 2 weeks.
Lucky, got a better offer.
You know, the chicken man, or the ice man, or the liquor man.
Damn, ain't nobody gonna change your luck, Tyrone.
They've got an energy that the old slide blues had a more kind of brooding energy, and these, you know, have that boogie-woogie piano in them, so that there's a real kind of upbeat energy in them. And I think also it's that, you know, that was also the kind of golden age of jazz, but because it was the founding age of jazz, and jazz hasn't really changed that much in some ways. It's, you know, jazz is now almost like classical American music. Because it was a transitional era, it's kind of gotten forgotten, you know, forgotten because of what came after it.
I was reminded of a recent production of Porgy and Bess, which was here in London, reminded me very much of certain scenes in your film, especially the fight scene, the flash of the knife, that kind of desperation to kind of have a night out. And then, you know, that connects very much to, I know that was an opera, but, it, you know, yeah. it's many of the founding tunes of jazz are in there.
Yeah, you know, I think some of what I was going for also was that, yes, there is that track down the middle of the street. What we're used to from Southern movies that have anything to do with race is movies about lynching, as if it was always that confrontational. And I think the more insidious thing is that assumption that everything is fine. But along with that assumption and along with a, you know, uneasy racial situation, what you have to realize is that there was a lively, vital world on the white side of the tracks and then a parallel one on the black side of the tracks, and they often spent weeks without thinking about each other or, you know, encountering each other. You know, so there was a totally self-enclosed, sufficient world on the black side of the tracks, and that's mostly what you see in Honey Dripper.
Let's touch on that. What is always a very difficult issue of race, maybe more sensitively divided in America than it is even here in the UK. You're a white director. Mm-hmm. You're filming a story of kind of, you know, a very black community story. You've done it before, as you say, in Sunshine State. Did you have qualms about saying, well, you know, is this my history? Do I have a right to explore this history and get a black cast together and make a song about the blue? Or do you meet some kind of resistance there, saying, well, this could be done by a black director? I know Denzel Washington's just done The Great Debate as a film I very greatly admire for the dignity in which he done it, but set in a similar place, and there's lynching in that film.
Yeah, I don't actually think about that. I actually think, you know, I grew up in America in a very mixed community, so, you know, this is just part of our history as far as I feel, and you just have to be able to pull it off like you have to pull off any neighborhood. I certainly feel more comfortable making a movie in an American Chicano neighborhood or African-American neighborhood than I would have coming over to Dublin and making a movie about contemporary Dublin. I would feel like I would need to stay for several years and probably even then have a guide or a book that had been written about there to use to get into there. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like race is an illusion. Culture is real. And these were parallel cultures at the time. One thing that's happened is both the music and the cultures have had a lot more to do with each other since 1950. And so what you're seeing in 1950 is very separate worlds. Mm-hmm. In fact, you know, it's one of the important metaphors in the movie that hasn't quite boiled over yet, which is that in those early rock and roll shows, one of the things that upset people about rock and roll the most throughout the United States, not just in the South, is that black kids and white kids were digging in at the same time. They would literally, in some of the places that didn't have a balcony where they could put the black people up in the balcony, they would stretch a rope down the middle of the audience, and the white kids would be kept on one side and the black kids on the other, and inevitably somebody grabbed the rope and yanked it down, and they would start to dance, you know, together.
A hairspray moment.
Yeah, and when that happened, the cops would stop the show and put the rope back up and say, that rope comes down one more time, we stop the show. You know, so already, you know, literally rock and roll was transgressive. It was putting people together who the powers that be did not want to have come together. And it's one of the great things about music, that very often, yes, it can be used to say, this is what I like and therefore I am this, but it can also be used to cross those ethnic and race barriers.
Now, I know it's something you've always done. I just had to ask that question because it was a feeling that came over me while I was watching this. I was swaying, I was tapping my toes, I was caught up in the affection that you clearly have for the era and for the music. But I just wondered if it was... You know, there was some resistance. I think maybe that feeling is a political feeling, you know, maybe a 1970s political feeling that
I
had there.
I'd say it's something you always have to be aware of. I think actually the more difficult thing is if you're making a movie and there's only one representative of the outsider group in it, there all of a sudden is a lot of weight on that one representative of, oh, God, there's only one of us in the movie and he's a criminal or whatever. Once you're including enough people to have this cross-section, to have, oh, there are class within this group. There are educated people and non-educated people. There are people who are religious and not religious. There are people who are a little shady and people who are totally above board within this community. It takes a lot of the pressure off of it, you know. And I think an interesting thing that's happened in America is that in the early 80s and before, if an African-American director was going to make something and it wasn't about race in a serious way, it was almost considered, oh, that's a wasted opportunity. And I think kind of starting with the movies that Sidney Poitier directed that were just kind of comedies, some of that pressure came off. And it says, okay, it's okay to loosen up. Mm-hmm. There's going to be enough of these movies made that, yes, some of them will be specifically about race relations, but the other ones really don't have to be. Yeah. So now we have African-American directors who don't feel like they even have to have the majority of the people in the movie be African-American. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to include African-Americans in that movie, but they could do science fiction, they can do action adventure, whatever, and there isn't that pressure of every movie has to be do the right thing, even though it's great when there is a do the right thing.
Somebody took that rope down, clearly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
the other joy that you've always given me in your movies is the kind of sweep of politics that kind of goes from bottom of the pile to the top and vice versa. And it's something you did in one of my favorite of yours, Hombres Armados, Men with Guns, which again, you know, you were a white director working in a kind of Latin American
indigenous context.
But again, through music, I mean, what came through part of the politics in that film was the music came through that film. You had wonderful kind of cumbias and all sorts of percussion-y instruments in that film. That was like a symphony.
I think one of the great things about music and one of the things that you always have to be aware of in movies is that, yes, movies are intellectual. They go through your head, but they also have a visceral component. You know, there's some stuff that just goes right to your gut and that makes you feel or react or whatever. And some of it is action and some of it is the scored music and the pounces and the, you know, the timpani and all that stuff. And some of it is the musical tone of the movie. And one of the first things I try to do in any movie is I start sending music back and forth with Mason Daring, the composer I've always worked with. And we try to get the tone of that, the voice of that movie. And it's different with everyone. Mm-hmm. In Brother from Another Planet, we wanted the brother from another planet who's a black-skinned man who's fallen from another planet, you know, to Harlem. And his voice is the steel drum. I wanted something, you know, slightly industrial but still organic, you know, for him. In Mate One, it's that mountain fiddle. It's Zydeco music and Passion Fish.
Which you did before, before O Brother Where Art Thou, I have to tell you.
Yeah, you know, but you know, it's what's appropriate to this movie and will give this movie a certain tone. Now, sometimes it's harder to find a specific thing than others. In this movie, you know, one of the lines of research that I did was, you know, what was on the jukebox in the Deep South in 1950? Well, what you hear on the soundtrack, you know, you hear some gospel, you hear some rockabilly, you hear some swing, you hear some Louis Jordan jump music, you know, you hear some, you know, Perry Como kind of ballads, you know, and you hear this stuff that's rhythm and blues easing toward proto rock and roll. Yeah. In fact, it has a backbeat, and, you know, if it hadn't been called rock and roll yet, it's really rock and roll.
And John Sayles' Honey Dripper is released next week on May the 9th. More music and indie spirit now, as this week sees the release of Joy Division, a new documentary about the Manchester band that gave us Ian Curtis and then New Order. Obviously, it recovers similar ground to last year's award-winning biopic Control, yet I was never bored. Such was the humour, strange beauty and intelligence behind this impressively assembled music doc. Directed by Grant G, it was written by the legendary punk historian John Savage, and their film is proper testament to both the fleeting, mad energy of youth and the inexorable grind of social history. I caught up with John Savage and asked him how he brought a film so close to his heart into cinematic life. John, congratulations on Joy Division. Just explain to me your sort of role in it, because it seems that you wrote it, but I mean, it was almost your story, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, in the very early days, when the project was being mooted, I had discussions with the two executive producers, Tom Astor and Tom Atenzio, New Order's American manager, and we knew that New Order were going to be on side and were going to do interviews. So it was just a question of trying to make it interesting, really, and. I lived in Manchester at the time. Joy Division was a local group, and I knew Tony Wilson and Martin Hannett and Rob Gretton very well, and used to go and see the group play all the time. And what struck me about them was that they very much were a band of their time and their place. They were, you know, a Manchester group, and they're very much, you know, a band of that time, 1979. And so it seemed to be interesting to try to, when telling their story, to try and, you know, just go beyond, you know, the story of Ian Curtis and the love triangle, which had been well explored in Control. We knew we didn't want to do that. So we decided to just go a bit deeper and talk about what Manchester was like then in 1979.
Yeah, it kind of legitimizes the whole process, doesn't it, to set it so immediately as a kind of product of its time and place.
Well, also we knew that we had these, I knew that these two films existed, one of which was shot by Malcolm Whitehead and was called Joy Division, and that's where the Super 8 of the group playing at Bowden Vale comes from. And also I knew there was this other film shot by Charles Salem and scripted by Liz Naylor called No City Fun. So I thought if we could find those two films, both of which were actually shot, you know, about Joy Division, then that would really add depth to the whole film.
So you knew they were lurking about sort of on Super 8 somewhere or undistributed or in someone's locker?
Yes. I mean, but that was really our first, you know, our first port of call was to try and find Malcolm Whitehead, which we did eventually, and also Charles Salem, and that took a few months, and we managed to find them both. The Charles Salem film hadn't been touched for nearly 30 years.
Yeah, it's got this wonderful, you know, I was reminded, I was at a gig the other night on Monday, and everyone was recording the guy singing on their mobile phones and on their little digital, you know, on their digital cameras. And in the end, I'm quite small, I have to watch gigs through hands anyway, and I end up watching it on someone's mobile phone, even though I was quite near the... And I'd just seen your film, and it reminded me of that kind of lo-fi footage, actually. Things haven't actually progressed that far in 30 years.
Well, in many ways, the footage on mobile phones is even worse than it is on Super 8. The point is that now, Joy Division, you know, there'd be hundreds of people recording it, and then there was only one or two. You know, there really isn't very much footage there at all. And that's because Joy Division were really operating before the explosion in youth media that happened in the early 80s.
Now, were they part of a scene or not? Your film very much puts them as part of a landscape. But I always thought the Joy Division, although they were part of Factory, they seemed to remain sort of apart from all the other kind of bands that were going on at the time.
Well, not really, you know. It didn't feel like that at the time. They were apart from the other bands because they were better.
Yeah.
But, you know, they played benefits for local magazines. Rob Grattan was quite careful to keep them as a people's band. You know, they weren't snooty. They were very approachable and very polite when you met them. You know, they weren't up themselves in any way. And no, they weren't really, you know, they didn't, I mean, they're only different from the other bands, as I said, because they were just a lot better. And that obviously at that point was a subjective, was a subjective judgment. In fact, in hindsight, they had been proved to be much better because the music just lasts. But, you know, no, I mean, at the time they were, you know, they were the best of many, but they were part of this explosion, if you like, of creativity. And that's what the whole factory thing was. It wasn't just the groups. It wasn't just Wilson. It was all the people who were involved. And they were, you know, from very, you know, Peter Saville and, you know, Martin Hannett and, you know, the other people who were involved were all very disparate.
Now, I've obviously seen Control, almost the anniversary of, since I saw it for the first time at the Cannes Film Festival. And I saw Control a few times, actually, over the following year. And I was still intrigued by your film. I think that's testament to the way it's put together and the way it's written and the way it's shot by director Grant Gee.
Yes, he did a wonderful job.
It's amazing because I knew the story very well by this time. And yet you were still managing to find something fresh. How did you do that? Did you wait till you saw what was going to be in Control before you really got everyone down and asked your questions?
Well, I haven't seen Control, but I sort of knew what was in it. I knew various markers that were in the story. I knew that the Berry riot was in it, and I knew... But obviously, you know, we were doing a film about Joy Division rather than Ian Curtis, and there is a subtle difference there in that we didn't focus too much on Ian's personal life. And in a way, the decision to talk about Manchester in the late 1970s was a part of that decision, really. Although it's a biopic, Control is still a work of fiction. So, I mean, you know, the official line is, you know, you've had the fiction, here's the reality. I mean, it was easy for me to do that because I'd been there at the time and knew everybody concerned.
Now, New Order hadn't... I know Hookie has spoken a few times about Barney Sumner, slightly more reticent. How did you get them all together? Or did you get their agreement separately? Did you know that you couldn't really do this without all the reminiscences of all the band members involved?
Well, I mean, as I said before, they were tied into the project from the start, thanks to Tom Atenzio, New Order's American manager. Also, you know, I've been in fairly constant contact with Joy Division, New Order, and their management in the intervening years, because I was friendly with Rob Grafton, and I'd become friendly with Rebecca Bolton, their English manager. And also I was involved with the Heart and Soul box set that was produced about 10 years ago, which was, you know, the major archival release on Joy Division at that point. And so, and as I said, you know, I the band were familiar with me. I'd interviewed them. You know, I'd been around, I'd gone to, you know, they'd seen me at the time, and they knew that I was part of the Factory family, and, you know, I'd bumped into them many times over the years. So, you know, that wasn't difficult, really, at all. No, it was just a question of getting them in to the studio and pointing the camera at them. They were very, they were very generous with their time.
Yeah, I mean, they were, and they were very generous with their stories as well. Have they spoken about these things before, or it seemed that they were coining them afresh?
Not to that extent. I mean, I think there's been bits and bobs. I think that because they were familiar with me, they were able to perhaps open up a bit more than they would have done to somebody who they didn't know. And also, we'd done our research. We knew what we wanted to ask. And for instance, we were very surprised that Burnham was perfectly happy to talk about the hypnotism tape where he'd hypnotized Ian to try and, you know, regress to past lives to try and help him. And he was very, you know, quite matter-of-fact when he was talking about this. And in fact, in Control, this is an incident that's presented as some sort of bit of black magic or something. But, you know, Bernard just thought he was helping his friend. So they were very matter-of-fact, really.
What do you see when you're approaching a film like this, John? What do you see your role as? Are you mythologizing? Are you documenting?
Documenting, yes. I mean, very much, you know, that's the first point. I mean, you know, we were very fanatical about getting the the stories right and the footage right. You know, it was very important. You know, the producer, Jackie Edenborough, did a fantastic job of getting us the footage that we needed, like the footage of the first Sex Pistols gig at the Free Trade Hall and stuff like that. You need that kind of stuff. Otherwise, you know, it's just the same as everything else, really. And I'm mythologizing. What's that? It's telling a story.
Yes.
It's important to tell a story. That's really all I can say about that, if that's mythologizing. It's a great story, and as I keep on saying, you know, the reason I always wanted to do this is just I thought they were great. I loved seeing them live. I loved the records. You know, live, they were just absolutely extraordinary. And, you know, it's just fantastic to me to see live footage of Joy Division, which has very rarely, if ever, been seen, full-size on a cinema screen with cinema sound. I mean, how great is that?
Yeah, no, it does. It comes across fantastic. I mean, in fact, I don't ever really want to see it on the telly because you need the size of the screen to actually sort of see the images because they're quite grainy. But yet, that gives them that sort of lo-fi. I kind of feel like it must have been to witness it through a fug of cigarette smoke in the Free Trade Hall or the pubs in the first place.
Yes, and also Ian's performances were so extraordinary.
It does actually bring into relief how good Sam Riley was as Ian in Control.
I haven't seen it, so I can't.
You still haven't
comment.
Seen it? Sorry, no. I thought you hadn't seen it yet before you made the film. Are you refusing to see it, or you're just waiting waiting for a free afternoon?
I'm waiting for a free afternoon. I have to say that I'm not that mad on biopics as a genre. I mean, it's nothing personal about Control. I know Anton Corbijn was very sincere, and I'm pretty sure, from all accounts, he did a really good job, you know. So, I mean, I don't have a huge attitude about it. It's just that, you know, I've been dealing with a story myself, so you just don't want to taint what you're doing by thinking about what somebody else is doing. You know, that's a pathway to madness, really.
John, as I said, you've helped document Britpop as well. What are there any other eras or areas of British popular music that need your cultural reassessment touch?
Oh, I don't know. I haven't got any immediate plans. It's more the topic. It's more. You know, trying to find an interesting topic rather than document an era, because in a way that's a bit presumptuous to think that you're going to do that when you go into it. It's very nice of you to say. You know, I just wanted to talk about Joy Division, really, and if it actually documents an era, then great, you know.
Well, that brings this era of Film Weekly to an end. This is the last show to be produced and assembled by Paul Noble, who's making a glorious exit to write a film score for a new project which will be shown on the South Bank later this summer. I thank him for all his nifty work over the last year and a half. Don't forget, this weekend sees the arrival of another Observer Film Quarterly, and in there you can read my exclusive interview with Keira Knightley, Can She Really Act, I Ask, as well as my reminiscences on Cannes with Mike Lee, and Bruce Weber takes me through the stories behind some beautiful photos of Chet Baker from the re-release of his jazz film Let's Get Lost. I'm Jason Solomons, and I'll be back with a new sounding Film Weekly next week. Until then, happy viewing.